All right.
Good morning.
Hi, how are you?
We have stuff to do today.
Things to learn. Let's see. Make sure I do this right so I don't scream at myself. Yes, today is indeed the 24th. So that would be there. Be there. Ardeen is here. Adamir. Dylan. Oh no, Jose. He must be stuck in traffic too. Reed. Lucas. No Amber again. Matthew. Anthony. Lex. Oh, there she is. There she is. Ethan. He's here. All right. Juliana, Michael.
Where should I sit? You should sit over
there. Yeah, you can sit there. Sit there. Aiden, Joseph, Carlton, Cole, Austin, Nico. Carol, Lawrence, Jose is here. All right, I'm pretty sure I got everybody. All right, I got these as well. Don't want them. So take it, pass that back, modify and roll, pass that back, modify and roll, pass those ones back. When your name pops up, take yours. Lucas, Reed. I say Reed, whoever graded your exam, a quiz did an exceptional job. Dylan, Jose, Anthony. Pass that back to me. Alright, Ethan, he's in this row. Pass that back to Ethan. Amber, Ethan. Angie. Perfect. Alright. So, we did that. Ah, here we go. Trial. This is where we left off. Bum, 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 bum. We talked about that. We talked about that. We talked about that. We talked about that. Boom. I think this is where we left off. Trial process. If you missed class the other day, don't worry about it. I'll get it up online. Trial process. That's what we're doing. We start off with the filing of the complaint, identify the parties, the defendant has to answer, of course they get a summons to go to court, there's the discovery, we talked about all that stuff. We've also saw two possible motions to basically end the litigation process, the trial process. You have a directed verdict, which comes in if a defendant doesn't answer in a timely manner. And of course, we saw a motion to dismiss, which is usually used during the discovery stage. And that's kind of where the defendant realizes, yeah, the plaintiff doesn't have anything. So let's not waste the court's time. Then we started talking about the trial itself. Obviously, we know we have judge, jury, opening statements. We have presentation of the evidence. We went through the two major types of evidence. Gave you a little warning about hearsay. And then we talked about the burden of proof in a civil trial, preponderance of the evidence, which is unlike a criminal case, which is beyond a reasonable doubt, which is like 99.99999, as close to the absolute truth as you can get. Preponderance of the evidence is kind of like it could have happened. You know, more likely than not is a good way to remember it. More likely than not. Did it happen? Maybe, or maybe not, but yeah, it more likely than I could have. Makes sense, reasonable. But of course, also remember, the burden of proof is like a bouncing ball. Or like on a tennis match. Bunk, bunk, back and forth, back and forth. Plaintiff presents his evidence, and if he presents enough evidence to convince the jury by preponderance of the evidence, then it's the defense's turn to present defenses. And defenses are meant to counter the claim. And then if the defendant proves enough or presents enough evidence, the burden shifts back to the plaintiff. And then it goes back to the defendant. And then sometimes it goes back to the plaintiff. And then it goes back to the defendant. Until both sides exhaust the presentation of their evidence. One of the fun parts of a trial comes with questioning witnesses. Because again, if you're going to present physical evidence, okay, you can put the video clip on the screen, put the pictures on the screen, you know, okay, that's fine. But questioning the witnesses, oh, that's where it gets really fun. Because both sides are playing a game of credibility. You're going to present your witnesses, right? You're going to present your witnesses. And you are going to, oh, I thought there was a click. I guess not. When you present your witnesses, what you are doing, what you are trying to do, is to engage in direct examination. Doing so in a friendly manner. You are trying to present to the jury that that person up on the box is beyond credible. And that person in the box is the ultimate source of truth. Like they are a saint. Now here's the funny thing. The questioning derives from the interrogatories or the depositions. So, if you depose a friendly witness and you ask them to speak in a way that points the finger at the defendant, you're going to ask them questions related to that. So, did you see defendant working at the store that day? Yes, I did. What was the defendant doing? Well, the defendant was mopping the floor. Okay. In your opinion, was the defendant acting in a way that was responsible as they mopped the floor? No, I happen to notice that they left a big puddle on the floor and then just walked away. Okay. Did you happen to see whether or not the defendant put a warning sign down? No, they did not. You're just asking them questions and they're telling a story. They're providing a narrative. For every witness, the other side gets to engage in cross-examination. Oh, so You happen to see my client, the defendant, in the store, as you claim. Yes. Do you wear glasses? Well, yes, I do. Did you have your glasses on this particular day? No, I did not. How do you know it was the defendant? Can you point the defendant out in the courtroom? Oh, the defendant's over there. Are you absolutely sure? Well, no, I was far away. How far away were you from the defendant? I was on the other side of the store. Same person, different line of questioning. One is meant at propping them up. The other is meant to destroy them. Because if you are engaging in cross, you want to make that witness look like they are Satan incarnate. Because as it goes on, the jury's sitting in the box saying, Now what happens if, after cross-examination, the party that called them wants to reestablish their credibility with another line of questioning? That's possible, because then you can go to redirect. Which, of course, would allow the other side to go to recross. And that can continue until they can't get anything more out. Witnesses can be your best friend. But witnesses can also tank a presentation before the jury. Why? How could a witness, the same witness, help or hurt you? What is the basic flaw of any person?
They talk too much.
Well, they talk too much, they lie.
Bias.
What?
Bias,
yeah. Does anybody actually have a photographic memory?
Pretty sure.
Pretty sure? Like you can remember every single second of any single situation. No. And then what happens when more time goes by after the incident? I tell you, I remember back when I was in third grade, I was the all-star, I was the A student, I was the most popular guy, all the teachers loved me, all the girls loved me, I was awesome. That's the way I remember it. Not even close. But again, that's the flaw. You can only get out of a witness what you can expect to get out of any reasonable person. And what happens if the jury doesn't like the way the person looks, the way the person sounds? Do you ever hear someone's voice that just grates on you like fingernails on a chalkboard? One of my best friend's wives, her voice when she talks literally sounds like a blood-curdling scream. And I can tell you, I don't care what she says. I just want her to shut the fuck up. Well, imagine you're in a jury and you're just sitting there. You're a human. And this is going on and you're just like, I don't care, I don't care, I don't care. What's going to happen when you go back into the jury room and deliberate? So the thing that I'm saying is that we cannot have a perfect system. Our system is the best that it can be. But again, the system is designed to compensate. So in addition to presenting evidence, in addition to presenting witnesses, during the trial there are also a series of motions that can be filed. And there's a whole bunch of them, but I'm only going to give you three of the biggest, three of the ones that we're going to see when you read the cases. The first, which you will see in your first homework assignment, is known as summary judgment. Summary judgment. Summary judgment is a motion that is filed when, during the trial, a party fails to present enough evidence to sustain their claim. It's a motion that's filed during trial when the party fails to present enough evidence to support their claim. Anyone need me to repeat that? It is a motion filed during trial when a party fails to present enough evidence to sustain their claim. It could be either, but most cases usually involve the plaintiff filing that. But defendants can do it as well. Now here's the catch. Just because you file the motion, you then kind of have a hearing on the motion. That's a sidebar session. That's separate for the trial. And then the party moving for summary judgment must basically be able to show that there's no dispute in material facts. So, I'm suing the store because my client slipped and fell on a wet spot. We got pictures, we got video, we got 5 dozen witnesses. The employee that left the puddle testified in it. It's like overwhelming. So what defense does the store have? Nothing. We're not going to waste the court's time anymore. We're not going to let the jury deliberate. If a judge grants summary judgment, the trial is over with the win against, or rather for, the party who can show that the other side is nothing. Now here's the catch. There is a reasonable person standard. Because if you go for summary judgment, that could be grounds for an appeal. Because what you're doing is the judge is making a decision. But the only way the appeals court will uphold that is if a reasonable person, a reasonable jury, could not dispute the situation. So what's a reasonable person? An everyday average person. So, presented with what's been shown before, there's no other way to come up with another conclusion. Questions? There's also a motion for directed verdict. So, summary judgment is where one party can't show enough to support their claim. Directed judgment is where a party produces so much evidence that there's no legal basis for a claim. Summary judgment, one party fails to produce enough, so the other side is doing it. Directed verdict is when you show it all and you believe it's a slam dunk. And again, like summary judgment, it could be either one. It could be defendant or plaintiff. Although, whereas typically summary judgment is filed by the plaintiff, typically directed verdict is filed by the defendant. But that's like we're talking 50-48. Questions on either? Just to repeat one more time, summary judgment is filed by the other party claiming the other side has no case. Directed verdict
is you file because you believe you crushed him. Well,
you answered my question.
I knew you were going to ask me that, and I anticipated it. Any other questions?
All right. The last motion that I want you to be aware of is called Janov,
which in English is judgment notwithstanding the verdict.
Judgment notwithstanding the verdict. Judicium non obstante verdicto. Janov is issued after a jury renders a verdict. So let's think of the court process. Both sides present their evidence. They make their closing arguments. The jury goes back into the jury room, deliberates, comes back, and makes a decision. Before the judge imposes the penalty, either party may file a motion for Janov.
Because guess what Janov does?
What?
It overturns the decision of the jury. This is the break glass in case of emergency scenario.
What happens if a jury goes off the rails?
What happens if there is no way a reasonable jury could find liability for a defendant because the plaintiff had nothing but, say, circumstantial evidence that can't tie the plaintiff or the defendant to the incident? Well, by all right, that could be a situation for summary judgment or directed verdict. Well, now the jury comes back and says, yeah, the defendant's 100% liable, and we, the jury, think that they should have to pay $2 trillion. Because we don't like corporations. That's not justice. You get justice when you prove your case. In my hypothetical, plaintiff did not. And then the jury demanding $2 trillion for a slip and fall incident? That makes no sense on any realm of possibilities.
So if you filed that, it's pretty much just up to the judge to determine whether they made a good case or not?
Yes. Then it goes right into the hands of the judge. If the judge believes that you presented a strong enough case that the jury got it wrong, and by the way, the judge must base this on, say, 9 out of 10 juries finding it the exact opposite way. That 9 out of 10 juries would have said, yeah, no way in hell is this a case. That's justifiable grounds for Janov. Now, Janov can be used for part of the jury's findings. So let's say the jury wants to say $2 trillion. Well, there's no way a judge is going to impose on a grocery store a $2 trillion penalty. So the judge will reduce it to $50,000. Or the judge could go as far as just to strike the decision 100%. Ultimately, our law allows judges to use Janovs to correct the mistakes of a jury. Because the goal is justice.
Questions?
So, I had to ask. So if a jury comes to a conclusion that something happened, who makes them say that they're wrong?
The other party is claiming that the jury got it wrong, so they're filing this motion. And then it's up to the judge to basically decide, did the jury get it right?
Because the goal is you want the jury always to be right. But every now and then a group could be wrong. Yes, Carol?
How often does it do not?
Rare. And by the way, out of these three common motions that occur during trial, chances are, if a judge uses Janov, that's the greatest likelihood that the appeals court... Because remember, you have an absolute right to a trial, but you do not have an absolute right to an appeal. But again, to keep it simple, 9 times out of 10, if a trial court uses Janov, you're probably going to get an appeal. Because the appeals court wants that to be rare. All right, other questions about any of the motions? All righty. So, the next step is, of course, closing arguments. Once all the evidence is presented, once all the witnesses are questioned, once all the during or trial motions are filed, both parties have a right to do the reverse of the opening statements. Typically, defendant goes first. So during opening statements, plaintiff typically goes first. During closing arguments, typically it's defendant that goes first. Because ultimately, the court wants to give the plaintiff a chance, all things being equal, to have the last say. Because after all, they're the one who's pleading for justice. Closing arguments are determined by the judge. Simple cases typically no more than a half hour, but like Karen Reed, the judge gave both sides an hour to make closing arguments. And what is it? It's just a summary of everything that the jury saw. Then, once both sides finish their arguments, the judge gives the jury instructions. The judge, for example, will tell them the rules of law that are applicable to the trial. The judge will also remind them of any evidence that was struck out or any hearsay, you know, that the judge basically overruled the presentation of. You can't consider the stuff, you know, that was stricken from the record. You only can consider, you know, what was presented and allowed, sustained. And ultimately, you must come with a decision that is fair and unbiased. The jury then goes into the back room, deliberates. There is no rule of deliberation. Every now and then you'll hear about a trial that the jury's in the back for like 15 minutes. That pretty much meant that one side was slam dunk. But then there's other situations where the jury deliberation just goes on and on and on and on and on. Now, by the way, the length doesn't necessarily show bias towards one side or the other. Typically, if the jury is deliberating for long periods of time, that means there's confusion. That means people inside the jury room just kind of do not understand. So ultimately, a lot of jurors will try to get it right. I'll be honest. I have never actually served on a jury. I've been called to jury duty a bunch of times, but I've never served. And the irony was, is when I passed the bar and I became a lawyer, under the law, legally, I was not allowed to serve on jury duty. Because if I get in a jury pool, and the moment the other jurors find out I'm a lawyer, who are they going to be listening to? Right, so they're not going to be able to form an unbiased opinion. But Massachusetts has since changed the law, and I could serve on a jury, but no attorney is going to want another attorney in the jury pool. So the last time I got called up to Fitchburg, I filled in my occupation. The bailiff just kind of looked down and he goes like, "You're going home soon." And sure enough, who do you think the first person to be dismissed was?
And imagine the look on all the other room full of people that was sitting there as I said, ta-ta.
If you get summoned to jury duty, you gotta go. You have to go.
They don't know your occupation before they.
No. Nope. No, because it's based on voter registration.
Oh.
All right.
Now, FYI, even after the jury gets instructions, that doesn't mean time stops. Ultimately, the moment the jury comes back into the room, and a verdict is going to be rendered, but up to the very second when the jury walks back into the courtroom, the parties can settle. Now, why on God's earth would you settle?
Money.
What do you mean money?
I'm getting paid. That's why I would settle. They're paying me to not go forward with, like, what they'd be charged with.
So you're plaintiff and you're suing me, and you want $1 million. Would you settle before the jury rendered its verdict?
It depends if like a good middle ground.
Well, you, so yeah, both sides, well, what's a good middle ground?
I'd say $500.
Fuck you, I'm not paying the $500,000. I'm paying you nothing, because I'm not liable for your claim.
Oh.
You shook your head, no, why? So, would you settle a claim? So, you're suing me for $1 million. The jury's in the deliberation room. Your attorney, my attorney, and negotiate. My attorney comes to your attorney and says, we'll give you $5,000. Are you going to settle on $1 million claim?
No.
Why not?
It's too small.
It's too small. But do you know what the jury's going to decide?
It doesn't matter.
What do you get if the jury sides for me and not you? Ah, that suddenly makes it interesting, right? So Andrew, he's a greedy bastard. He's like, I'm not settling for, I'm suing you for $1 million, but I want half, the minimum. But Ardeen, like, she doesn't want to look at lowball. Would you do 10,000?
No, that's so small.
How about 50?
I
get 10. Again, remember.
Just say no.
Remember, it's 50 guaranteed we settle, or the jury comes back, which is a 50-50 shot that you get zero. Ah, see what we just did? And by the way, here's the scary thing. About 90 to 95% of civil claims are settled. They don't actually go to a jury decision. Because of that reality, do you want to get something? Because if the jury comes back and sides with me, you get nothing other than potentially a bill from your attorney.
Questions?
I mean, so you don't have to settle, right?
No, you don't have to.
So it's like,
here at the blackjack, I mean the craps table, let's let the dice roll.
If I feel like I got a strong enough case, I'm going to just wait for the jury.
I can tell you one thing, your lawyer will be talking you in the ear. Yeah, saying, remember, it's all or nothing. It's all or nothing.
He's trying to remind me you got to pay him for
it. Well, yeah, exactly. Well, here's the funny thing. Even if you get the $1 million, chances are you owe that lawyer a third. All right. Any other questions on trial? Yes.
So say you did win $1 million, but this is not a price. Do you get taxed on that as well?
No.
Okay.
You don't get taxed on verdicts.
Wow.
Because what that is that's trying to cure your harm. But that doesn't mean you get your $1 million. Again, cut off a third, because a third of it's going to your lawyer. And why are you suing for $1 million? I can guarantee you probably got medical bills. You probably got property damage. You probably lost wages.
So do you get taxed on your third?
What?
Do you get taxed on your third that you're getting?
Oh, yeah, absolutely, because that's income for me.
That's
right. Yeah. All right, other questions?
you not settle and go all the way to trial if the verdict in your favor can be used as evidence in like some other case?
I don't know why you would do that. Because
if you have a chance to get some money, would you risk it all to lose just so you can try? Because the only other trial that would be involved in that particular circumstance would be a criminal. So if you're suing civilly and you have a chance to get some compensation, if the person goes to jail, you're going to get no money. So why would you risk getting nothing just to prove a point? I mean, you can,
but I don't know why you will. Would.
I agree. There's always unique situations. But again, more likely than not, you're going to want to get your money. Plus, by the way, FYI, criminal usually goes before civil. Criminal usually goes before civil. So, O.J. Simpson, found not guilty by a reasonable doubt by a jury of his peers, because the glove didn't fit, so he had to acquit. But then a few months later, the family sued for wrongful death, which is a civil claim.
Why didn't they do the Janov in the O.J. trial?
Why didn't they do the Janov in the O.J. trial? Because the government doesn't have the right to perpetuate and exhaust taxpayer dollars. So, based on the evidence that was presented, the prosecution could not prove their claim beyond a reasonable doubt. And even if they were to do a retrial, everybody who was alive at the time was watching. Everybody knew what took place at the trial. You could not get another unbiased jury pool. So if the prosecution was to file the Janov, that would waste taxpayer dollars. And chances are Judge Ito, who was the judge, I'm amazed that I remember his name, but again, that's what happens when that's the most popular thing on TV for months, he would not have granted it.
Other questions? All right. What's next? An appeal? No. Remember? Lemanic's rule.
You have an absolute right to a trial, but you do not have a right to an appeal.
I've already talked about the appeals court. I did that the other day. So I will review. One, an appeals is not a new trial. It's a tribunal. There's no jury. There's no evidence. There's no witnesses. Essentially, your attorney is going to claim that during trial, something went wrong, legally or procedurally. The only way to get an appeal is if you can show error. So just to bring things together, as I said, the Janov, that was a complete determination by the judge. Could that judge be unreasonable in believing that most juries would have found the other way? Yeah, it's possible. It's possible.
So there's the error. Improper use of Janov. Improper allowance of evidence or other some type of procedural rule that was violated or legal rule. And who makes the error?
Well, the jury could have gotten wrong. The judge could have gotten wrong.
After all, the judge is the trier of law. If the judge, for example, gives the wrong elements to the rule of law in the case, well, the jury used what the judge said to make its decision and came up with the wrong result. And by the way, I'm going to use the phrase elements today of a rule of law for the first time. We're going to see what I mean in a few minutes. As we said before, it could be the rules of procedure, the way the court's supposed to do things, or it could be substantive law.
This should already be in your notes. We've already covered it.
because you don't have a right. It's completely up to discretion of the appeals court. If the appeals court decides to grant the appeal, then, like we said, both sides prepare what are called legal briefs, long essays, in which you include your side, case law, substantive rules of law, whatever it is you think is necessary to show that there was an error made. And of course, the other side is going to do the same thing, showing no, that it, there is no error. Then on a day determined by the appeals court, there's what's called oral arguments. As I've said that, I said that previously, two classes ago or three classes ago. I don't remember when we covered it. The person bringing the appeal goes first, basically gets asked questions by the three-judge panel. Most appeals courts have three judges on it. And then after that person gets their hour, the other person gets to go. Typically, it's an hour in the appeals court. And again, it's not a presentation. It's not like if you have a class and you have to give a presentation for a final product. You're not going to be able to get up and you're not going to be able to, you know, read off your notes and control the flow. No, you're going to sit there and it's almost like a job interview. The judge is going to ask questions, ask questions, ask questions. As I said, they don't make a decision on the spot. They have a meeting called a conference later. Could be a month later, could be 2 months later. Depends on how busy the appeals court is. And the judges behind closed doors talks amongst themselves over what were the questions, what were the answers. And what do they think? Then once they make a decision, they give the opinion of the court, or in Latin, the opinion per curiam, the opinion of the court. When you do your readings of the cases, you are reading excerpts that I've prepared that come from the opinions of the appeals courts. And what do they conclude? Well, the first part is the opinion of the majority. So if you have a three-judge panel, how many judges make up the majority? You gotta have at least two. Why do they have an odd number? Yeah, you don't want ties. You want to be able to make sure that a decision can be made. Either that an error was made or not. The opinion contains the ruling on the issue. It contains reasons for the court's decision. It contains relevant rules of law and any other facts that the court feels is necessary in making its outcome. And I've already given you these. Nope. There was no error. The court below was correct. We affirm the decision. Nope. Maybe they almost got it right. I don't think I included this one last time. Maybe they almost got it right. Well, we just got to clean up a little bit. What happens if they got it so wrong? We're gonna flip it. The original loser becomes the winner. Let's go to reverse. And last but not least, if a portion needs to go back and get tweaked, it's remanded. It's sent back down. A remand could involve either a new trial or a partial trial. I'm busy. Every single phone call that goes off, that could be $200 to $300 just for me to answer the phone. And look at what I'm doing. I'm choosing to let it go to voicemail. Because I care about your education.
Sure. All right. Questions? Again, most of this, if not all of it, should be in your notes already. If it's not, hopefully you got it. If you didn't write it down, I see students pick up your phone and take a picture. Here. How's that? You have me a picture of me. Then as you're sitting there studying, like, what the hell is LeMay doing? Are we good? Because then I'm going to fire off what happens if you want to appeal the appeal. We've done that as well. Oh, it goes to the high court. It goes up. And if we're talking federal courts, what about the Supreme Court of the United States? As we know, because we covered it, there's one of two ways to get to the top court. On the federal courts, it's either by appeal or original jurisdiction, which we did cover. An appeal is a request from a court below to look at an error. An original jurisdiction is where the Supreme Court holds a trial, more often than not when a state is involved. To get to the Supreme Court, you have to request by filing, which we wrote on the board, a writ of certiorari. Because I remembered, I butchered certiorari. So, you actually have to petition. You have to plead with the court. Hey, can you issue that order to bring it up to, because that's what a writ of certiorari is. It's to bring up all of the relevant information for review. But like an appeals court, you do not have an absolute right to have the Supreme Court review your claim. The Supreme Court typically denies anywhere between 85 and 90% of the petitions it receives. Typically, there's about 8,000 requests. But on most given years, I told you before, only they hear about maybe 70 cases. Now, how are you going to get up to the Supreme Court? Well, there's a couple of ways. The most obvious is there's got to be something big constitutionally at stake. But the other way is remember, there's 12 circuit courts, as I told you. And each of those circuit courts are appeals courts. What happens if a similar case gets to the appeals court and each one renders a different decision on the same subject matter? Well, you can't have three different opinions. So if there's a conflict, that's more likely than not that it's going to get up to the Supreme Court, because the Supreme Court wants there to be one. Another way, the judges below could be overstepping their bounds. So I'll give you a controversial recent decision by the Supreme Court. When the Supreme Court basically told all the federal trial judges that they cannot put injunctions on actions by the executive branch on a national level. When ICE was going around and they first started operating, people would go to liberal judges trying to get an injunction from that liberal judge to stop ICE action. Well, the problem is a federal judge in, say, San Francisco has no jurisdictional authority over what happens in Massachusetts or New York or Utah. And there were these judges all over, mostly liberal, mostly appointed by Democrats, that were basically imposing injunctions on multiple actions by the executive branch. Supreme Court, in an expedited plea, took them all up and rendered a decision that said they cannot do that.
If the San Francisco judge wants to impose an injunction, it only applies to the district in which they sit,
not the entire United States. Why? You can't have rogue judges making up their own rules.
But even if you have judges making up your own rules, that still doesn't guarantee you're going to get in, because by procedure, the Supreme Court operates under what's referred to as the rule of four. Four of the nine must want to hear the case. The rule of four. Now here's the funny thing. That doesn't mean all four agree. Three of them may like what's going on below, but one of them does not. Or maybe it's the other way around. The judges don't have to give their reason why they want to hear it. They just got to sign on to it. If four judges grant the cert petition, the order goes to the court below and all the details come up. And then guess what happens? Just like at the appeals court, both sides prepare briefs. There's a presentation of oral arguments. Once the oral arguments occur, the justices meet at a later date in the private chambers in their conference, and they make deliberations and determinations. And then once they decide, they issue their opinion pure curiam, the opinion of the court. And what does the opinion contain? The ruling, the reasons, the rules of law, and any other information that they want. But at the Supreme Court level, there's only one of three outcomes. There is no modification. Affirm, reverse, remand. Last class and a half, that's probably the most complicated material that I'm going to give you all semester. Because this is all the procedural stuff. But I take the time to do it so that when you read the cases and you see these phrases, you understand what's going on. Before I give you your technically second, because we got the rule of law that we got out of Kuhn and Bubsa. But before I give you our second substantive rule of law, anyone have any questions on any of the procedural stuff? This is my favorite segment, because this is gonna blow your mind. Our first major, technically it's our second rule of law, but we'll say this is our first major one, because we're not only gonna look at the rule of law, but we're also gonna map out all of the exceptions to the rule of law. And it's easy to understand, and it's gonna make you go, bystander's rule of obligation. The bystander's rule of obligation. Before we move forward, what is a bystander? Someone is just kind of standing on the side of the road, watching an event play out. To be a bystander, what must you not do?
Get involved.
Get involved.
What does obligation mean?
What you're supposed to do.
What you're supposed to do.
All right. So we're going to deal with a huge corner of civil law. If you're standing by and you see something play out, what do you have to do? That wasn't lawyer stuff, that was selectman stuff. Jesus fucking Christ. You know, I was home all morning long. I woke up at 4 o'clock in the morning. I went out and I did my walk. Came back, I worked on your class a little bit. I did some other stuff. Well, I was there, I left the house at 10:30 like I usually. All that time, did my phone go off? No.
For $50 a phone call, I'll give you secondary all class and I won't answer your phone calls.
Oh boy, I like that. All right, here's a hypothetical situation.
Obviously, it involves a man and a child. Here are the facts.
Who's my guinea pig? Andrew wants to be the guinea pig.
I mean, it sounds bad, but I said no.
No. Why?
Because he's a bystander.
Why?
He's not. Look, why don't you save your own child? That's what I'm saying. I don't.
Where did it say it was his own child?
No, he's saying,
he's saying to the parents. You ever hear stories, a kid gets out of the house during the day, parents don't know where they are?
Well, that's their fault.
We had one in our town. A little girl got out, went into a pool, and she drowned.
I feel like
it's
a kid.
I agree with him on that aspect, but I also think how much time does he have? Does it look like there's not enough time? Does it matter?
Is 15 seconds, 30 minutes. Well, time is not a factor.
I think it should be.
Yeah. Why?
Because, I mean, if it's obviously it's 2 minutes down the road, he should go in. But if it's 15 seconds, you know, away, it's kind of closer. If he doesn't know if he has enough time to save or not, then I wouldn't say, I don't think he's liable.
Okay, so you're saying that time should be considered?
Yes.
Because what if he saved her and then he got her? Would it be maybe liable for him now?
Right.
Did you hear that?
I like what she's thinking.
What happens if dude does respond and he gets her? Can he turn around and sue the parents? Anyone else?
Right.
What is the essential piece to have a person potentially be liable? What must they have done?
Cause
the harm. Look at the facts. The man saw with his eyes. Did he put the kid in the road?
No.
Did he put the kid near the road? Was the man driving the truck?
No.
Did the man sit there and go to the truck like, come on, go faster, go faster?
No.
Does time matter? Like Lex said. No! Because of what Amber said. The law does not expect you to intervene. Because if you choose to intervene, you could succumb to the harm. And can the law force you to harm yourself? No. No. So, the fact that the guy just kind of sat back, in this modern day and age, he'd probably do one of these with his phone. You know, doing the picture or the video with him in it. Oh no, look at the kid! And have the kid go...
Yeah.
But even in those circumstances, because the man didn't put the child in harm, because the man did not contribute to the harm, there is no way in hell, under any circumstances, that person can be held liable.
Why? Simple. The bystander's rule of obligation, which is a common law decision that has been handed down and maintained for hundreds of years. One has, it should be no duty, not duty, one has no duty to assist someone in peril unless they created the danger. One has no duty to assist in someone in peril unless they created the danger.
Also, why would you want to sue the family and not the dude who just ran over the kid?
Right.
I mean, the man watching.
What?
Like, if you were watching, like, you're suing the man watching and not the dude who...
That would be a separate claim, would it not?
You could sue both.
You can sue as many people as you think contributed to your harm. Any other questions? Well, let's scale it up a little bit. Everyone get the bystander rule of obligation?
Yeah.
By the way, do not be surprised if on a quiz or an exam, I ask you to write out the rule. So what are the necessary elements that must be shown? One has no duty to assist someone in peril. Element number two, unless they created the danger or contributed to the harm. You're going to see it expressed in different bunch of different ways. But the gist of it's still there. All right? Fact pattern number two. This is a real case. Union Pacific Railroad Company, the Cape Ear case that was decided in 1903. Here we go. Who's going to be my guinea pig this time around? All right, what do you got, Jose? By the way, this side of the room, I think, is going to be inclined to get lots and lots of extra points. Just saying.
I don't think the railroad is liable because why is the guy crossing the tracks while there's incoming?
That's not the right question to ask.
Huh.
What is the only question that should be going through your head?
Did they cause it?
Did they cause the harm? Who caused the harm to this individual? What? No!
The guy.
He caused the harm! Because what did he decide to do?
Cross the tracks.
Would a reasonable person attempt to cross the railroad tracks when a train was coming? And by the way, do you think the train was in stealth mode?
Right.
Did it have camouflage on? Kansas court that decided this, the court said no. No liability. No liability. Because, by the way, notice, there was an incident where employees actually intervened. They did get involved, but their involvement didn't make the situation worse. So I'm going to change it up a little bit. What happens if the yard man saw the man and yelled, "Jump in front of the train!" Well, you might say that might have contributed to the harm. Because maybe the guy was kind of hesitating. And maybe I really don't want to. Okay, he said to, so now I will. Or what happens if, when the staffers attempted to give aid, they decided to just kick on the guy's chest? That could contribute to the harm. That could be grounds for liability.
but they did nothing to make the situation worse.
The only one responsible is this guy.
Now, by the way, this is something you need to remember, and it's hard to do, because most people are not cold-hearted, cruel bastards like I am. Most people have compassion, have emotions. I don't, but most people do. But here is something to remember. The court does not make its decision based on moral grounds. Why? And by the way, once we get with this, we're going to do a little ethics before we have our first exam. Why?
We're not heroes?
No, not necessarily.
Moral is criminal, civil is just...
What's morality?
It's up to you. It's different for everybody.
No. What you think is the right thing. Well, guess what? I may have a difference of opinion.
Everybody does.
So can you have the court making subjective decisions based on how that particular person feels? No, because you could not have justice. Every single decision would be different. I'm so sorry. You want a tissue? Too bad. No tissue for you. And as the court said, you don't have to write this down. With the humane side of the question, courts are not concerned. Remember, the statue of Lady Justice, she is blind. She has a veil over her eyes. Because of this reason. It is the omission or neglect or negligent discharge of legal duties only which come within the sphere of judicial cognizance. Is somebody responsible based on their actions? Yes or no? That's it. That's all a court will look at. All right, last one, and you'll be ready to do your first homework assignment, which will be due on Monday. Osterlin v. Hill. By the way, this is a Massachusetts court case. 1928. By the way, the time doesn't matter. I'm just putting the years in so that way you can see how long this has been rules that the courts have followed. Ready for this fact pattern? Is the guy who rents the canoe liable? Yeah. Anybody who would see him would know he was drunk. He was completely off his ass shit.
When he rented the boat?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, all right, so.
So, Bill knowingly rented out the canoe to him, knowing that he was under the influence.
Where in Massachusetts law, even today, does it say you cannot rent a boat when you're inebriated?
No, I don't know what I'm saying.
That's exactly what you said. Because you're saying he granted him the boat even though he was drunk. What I'm saying is that illegal? My sarcasm is kind of hinting at not really.
Okay. Yeah, but nowadays, like if you go rent a boat, they're going to say, we're not going to rent it to you if you're under the influence.
So yeah, why do you think they're going to do that?
They put that in so they're not liable.
They don't even want to have their time wasted. Yeah. Because this was a trial that went to an appeal. Mm. So Hill had to spend money on lawyers to defend himself. But guess what the outcome was? No liability. Bystander's rule. Nice. Why? Well, as the court stated, on the facts stated in the declaration, the intestate, who was the dead person, was not in a helpless condition. He was able to take steps to protect himself. If you are drunk, what should you not do? Maybe rent a canoe?
The defendant violated no legal duty in renting a canoe to a man in the condition of the intestate. There is no law on the books that says I cannot rent a canoe to someone who is drunk. That's the same situation. No, it's your choice. You're the person who made yourself drunk. You're the person who decided to rent the bicycle. I'm just a businessman trying to make a buck. All right, homework number one. It's on my website. It is the instructions say, you be the judge. I am very mean on this first one. I give you all the facts, and I give you the issue for why it went to the appeals court. It's up to you to use your notes that we, the stuff we've covered, to come up with a logical decision. So the only thing you need to write out on a piece of paper, because you're going to hand them in when we're done, is what you think the outcome should be and why. Have a lovely weekend, y'all.
Can I get one of those papers?
I printed it out.